Chapter 36. Questioned by this author during an audio-taped 2014 interview for The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, Ron Pataki, continuing his defensive mode, chastised those who believed he had something to do with the killing of Kilgallen as fools, someone with a Bigfoot mentality. Among his other declarations were, "Kilgallen was a wonderful, wonderful friend. We talked nearly every day. Kilgallen liked to write romantic-sounding things, little notes, but I stayed away from that." Author Lee Israel interviewed him at his Ohio home and appeared to him to be angry. "I felt Israel was a dyke who had a crush on Kilgallen. She seemed surprised that a Midwesterner like me would be so close to Dorothy." Regarding why people might suspect that he was involved in Kilgallen's death, "Why do I give a damn? These people need to get a life." Concerning Mark Sinclair, "He was a pain in the ass, Dorothy told me. He had every fault in the world for a hairdresser." Informed Sinclair stated Kilgallen had shared with him the romantic nature of the relationship, he commented, "Dorothy would never. Dorothy would never have said that. Mark Sinclair is a hairdresser. I rest my case." Asked if Kilgallen had confided in him about the JFK assassination, and especially her manuscript, "Sure, we worked on it. I think she was probably 50% researched on that. She was getting close, I can tell you. If you have 50% of your project finished, it's all downhill from there. The other 50% is filling in the blanks, you know?" Pataki's voice level elevated when confronted with his having said in a prior interview that his mother Daisy in Columbus told him about Kilgallen's death. He told this author, "That's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. Why would I ever say anything as outrageously untrue as that?" Asked whether he was the late date Bob Back believed Kilgallen had at the Regency Hotel bar a few hours before her death, Pataki emphasized, "I wasn't there. I don't have the luxury of knowing what he thought, you follow me?" He then added, "As well as I know Dorothy, and keep in mind I knew her better and more intimately, without sex, than anyone we are discussing, and I can't conceive of her even trying to give that impression of me being the late date, although she did write little cute notes all the time that would lead anyone who read them to think something was going on. But that's just the way she was. She was flirtatious in a non-sexual way." Queried about whether he had ever been in Kilgallen's townhouse, Pataki said, "No, it was not my place to go there. I'd drop her off in a cab, and she'd go right in the street-level entrance." Questioned about a nasty column he had written about New Yorkers shortly after Kilgallen died, details to follow, Pataki said, "Keep in mind, I was very hurt by Dorothy's death. I was destroyed by it." He then panned the so-called sophisticated New York audience, alleging 80% of them are from Dubuque, Iowa. Regarding Mafia Don Sam Giancana, Pataki replied, "I met him. He came to Columbus, Ohio to hear girlfriend Phyllis McGuire sing one night. I almost put my head in a noose. I was bird-dogging her. She was willing to play, you know. Dorothy got into the picture. But there was no romance between Phyllis and myself, as it turned out. No evidence exists that Giancana ever visited Columbus." Asked to comment on the extent of the drugs in Kilgallen's system, discovered by John Broich and Drs. Baden and Hoffman after she died, Pataki stated, "Number one, I've never heard about that until right now. Number two, I don't believe one word of it. I have seen the truth run down, turned over, and broken by fools. You shouldn't follow the words of these fools." Asked if Dorothy could have been the victim of foul play, he added, "No, I don't believe there was foul play at all. I do not know if she took those pills. My first awareness of anything medical was that the doctors had found enough of this or that, but not enough to kill her. But mixed with alcohol, it could have stopped her heart." In a separate audio-taped interview, Pataki had provided a somewhat different explanation for Kilgallen's death. "As a cold, hard fact, I would have to assume she committed suicide." "I think that's a fair assumption." "Oh no, I don't mean committed suicide. I was thinking of other than murder. My strongest inclination is that If I think about it at all, it's that she OD'd. Took a little too many pills, just a little too much whiskey. She was small. It would not take a lot to just quiet her down to where her heart stopped. No evidence exists Kilgallen ever drank whiskey. Regarding his not attending Kilgallen's funeral, Pataki said, I could not have gone. No, I couldn't have gone. The most important thing in my life had been removed. He added, Keep in mind, we spoke nearly every day, and at length. I helped her with many projects, and she helped me. She'd call and say, Let me read something to you. One was the lead to the Jack Ruby story, and she said, I don't like the lead very well. What do you think? And I said, Well, it's a little dry. Why don't you try to make it a little mysterious? Like two unidentified men sat in a nightclub, talking in hushed tones. She had told me this is what happened, part of the Jack Ruby story. One was Jack Ruby talking in a nightclub. But she didn't make it sinister enough, given the nature of the story. I just rattled that off, and she said, Let me get that down. Asked if the New York City authorities had contacted him, Pataki said loudly, They talked to me, to some other people, to confirm that I was in Columbus, and I was. Everyone knew it. Pataki also confirmed again that he talked to Kilgallen nearly every day. When confronted again with his being at the Regency Hotel bar with her during the early morning hours of November 8th, he stated, I don't care what people say. Let's deal with fact. And I'm not sure that there was a guy with her. When told that several other people had seen the man, he said, She went from P.J. Clark's to the Regency. Are you convinced of that? Let me give you an old man's wisdom. Some people say things like that to get themselves into the limelight. Note. There is no evidence the NYPD or anyone from law enforcement telephoned Pataki or others in Columbus. Pataki admitted he had been to the Regency Hotel bar more than 20 times with Kilgallen. I'd always said hi to the bartender, he explained. I'd have thought someone would talk to him. He's sort of the hairdresser of the booze business. They know everything. Note, efforts by this author to reach John Mann, the bartender on duty at the Regency Bar the night before Kilgallen died, were unsuccessful. Apparently, hotel executives made him unavailable to researchers following word of Kilgallen's death in 1965. Ron Pataki did not come forward and question the medical examiner's cause of death or defend her reputation in any way by contacting the authorities or a news outlet and explaining that she would have never overdosed. However, one day, after failing to attend his best friend's funeral on November 15, 1965, he actually partied in New York City. The proof comes from nationally syndicated columnist Earl Wilson's November 17th column. It detailed actress Mia Farrow's appearance a day earlier, the 16th, at Arthur, a new nightclub in NYC, owned by Richard Burton's former wife, Sybil. She was there to watch a CBS documentary featuring Frank Sinatra. Earlier, Kilgallen had reported the budding romance between Farrow and Sinatra. Wilson wrote, Mia proceeded to Arthur with Sheila McRae, Jack Carter, Jackie Leonard, drama critic Ron Pataki, and her mother, Maureen O'Sullivan, and broke out and danced. This meant Pataki, while he deliberately avoided attending the funeral of the most important person in my life, was in New York City, enjoying the nightlife a day after Kilgallen was laid to rest. Pataki never wrote a tribute column about Kilgallen. In fact, he never wrote any column about her, shortly after she died or any time in the future. Instead of doing so, he landed in New York City in party mode. And then, instead of basking in the glow of the evening he spent with stars abounding all around him, and relishing mention in Wilson's prestigious column, Pataki wrote a seething column entitled Arthur, Heaven Help Us, another in dump of dumps. The Columbus Citizen Journal published it on the 18th, one day after Wilson's column ran nationally. In a vicious, angry attack on the New York social scene, with the possibility he was taking a potshot at Kilgallen, There are three instances of his derogatory references to columnists. Pataki called Arthur a place where real New York mingles with unshaven, unkempt girls and their frowsy-haired dates. He said the bar was a dump, where you can find stars there to be seen, columnists there to see, and the scum of the city there to say they've been there. He then attacked patrons, calling them the cancer this decade calls culture, while adding, in truth, New York audiences are the stupidest collection of dull clods ever to set foot in a club or theater. He ended the article by criticizing big people who lure idiotic phonies to places like Arthur. One must wonder whether Pataki would have dared posting such a column if Kilgallen were still alive, especially since she had written two recent columns lauding Arthur as a hot Manhattan night spot, with also the mention of the second honeymoon, enjoyed by Sybil Burton Christopher, one of Arthur's owners, and Pataki. If all of the inconsistent statements Pataki has made through four decades and counting, pointing toward incriminating conduct regarding Kilgallen's death, were to be ignored, there would still remain uncontroverted evidence that somehow, someway, he was involved in her death. This is because of the lethal nature of two poems Pataki wrote in his own hand many years after Kilgallen died, signaling clear complicity, since the words he used could only be about his best friend and her death. The first is called Never Trust a Stiff at a Typewriter. It includes the stanza, "There's a way to quench a gossip's stench that never fails. One cannot write if zippered tight. Somebody who's dead could tell no tales." Questions to be asked include, is the stiff at the typewriter Kilgallen? Is the gossip with the stench the famous columnist? Is the way to quench the stench to kill her so that she was zippered tight and could tell no tales? Most curious, if the poem wasn't about Kilgallen, why the reference to the gossip's typewriter? Since, by the time this poem was written, computers were the call of the day. Adding to the intrigue is a second poem from Pataki's hand. Vodka Roulette, seen as relief possibility. Typed alongside a color image of what appears to be a bartender mixing drinks, it reads, "While I'm spilling my guts, she's driving me nuts. Please fetch us two drinks on the run. Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison, and don't even tell me which one." Reading this poem carefully, certain conclusions may be reached as to the meaning or hidden meaning of the words Pataki used, and also the image of the bartender pouring drinks. For instance, is Pataki the bartender, either at the Regency Bar or at Kilgallen's Time House, who mixes her drinks to make one of them poison? Are the words, "while I'm spilling my guts," a reference to Pataki informing on Kilgallen? Can the words, "she is driving me nuts," be construed to mean that Kilgallen finally realized Pataki was a snitch and threatened to expose him as the one who leaked her JFK assassination investigation evidence? If so, then maybe her constant questions to him, the insinuations that he was leaking her evidence, were too overwhelming to the point of substantial irritation. More disturbing, more incriminating, is that the poem is a virtual blueprint of the most plausible explanation for how Kilgallen died. The words chosen provide a surefire roadmap of his having been a rat who double-crossed Kilgallen by divulging important details about her JFK assassination to the wrong people, and her having suspected him of doing so based on evidence she discussed with Sinclair. Pataki then notes in the poem there somehow having been two drinks involved in her death. Recall Dr. Umberger was given two glasses from the crime scene, arguably hers and his. He then refers to how the person in the poem could have been poisoned by spiking one of the drinks with poison, the likely scenario leading to death. Even the words in the title of this poem are incriminating. Vodka Roulette was the choice, with vodka Kilgallen's favorite, the liquor chosen, instead of many other choices available. Gin, whiskey, others. And one doesn't have to speculate as to the meaning of relief possibility, since these words appear to mean that since Kilgallen was dead, there was relief on his part, since there was no possibility she could ruin his career by telling the world he was a low-life snitch. While many other factors enter into pinpointing Pataki as having silenced Kilgallen, including the other poem mentioning her being zippered tight, common sense dictates that Pataki's creation of this poem is a confession of sorts, stuffed with facts only he could know, if he was instrumental in her death. No other explanation seems viable, since before the poem's existence, there had never been any information released or theories proposed that Kilgallen died in the specific manner Pataki described. Vodka, poison, two drinks, etc. Certainly, it would seem, any competent detective or a knowledgeable district attorney in this day and age, if provided these likely admissions, would thoroughly investigate Pataki, since he had admitted knowing facts that only Kilgallen's killer or someone close to the killer could know, after review of the forensic evidence proving she was murdered. Unfortunately, as will be revealed, despite knowledge of Pataki's conflicting statements, this poem and the second one, no investigation would result. A certain denial of justice. During this author's October 22, 2014 interview, Ron Pataki acknowledged writing the poem "Never Trust a Stiff at a Typewriter." In his defense, Pataki said, "I didn't write that until the bulk of the material I wrote, until after about 1998. It wouldn't be to reflect back about one person, even Dorothy at that late date when I'm writing thousands. You know, there are over 3,000 poems in my books." Asked about the poem "Vodka Roulette" seen as relief possibility, he asked, "Is that the one that begins, 'Just skip all the noise and make one of them poison, and don't even tell me which one?'" Assured it was, Pataki commented on why certain people believe the poem is about Kilgallen and the possible cause of her death. Pataki stated, "Do you understand how silly that sounds to me? The friends I have known throughout my life would put no more stock in anything we've discussed today or Lee Israel than flying a kite to the moon." Asked again if Pataki understood why others might still feel the poems related to Kilgallen's death due to the mention of poison, he became quite agitated. "Two short poems out of 3,000, he said, "and you're trying to hatch an egg. I think stupid people should have to wear signs, though it might be a turnoff to Cubans." Pataki answered the follow-up question, "Well then, what inspired the poems?" by saying, "I don't get inspired to write a poem. It is work. I do it for a living." Questioned directly if he had any direct involvement in Kilgallen's death, Pataki replied, "Absolutely nothing." Then he said, "Listen, I'm going to make a statement. Only a damn fool would read either of the poems you pointed out and think they had something to do with Dorothy's death. Number one, they were done 40 years later or more after her death, and they make no hint of Dorothy. One is about poison 40 years later. You're on the wrong track in my book." Pataki's admission that the poem or poems had not been written until after about 1998 means he created them following the bizarre Westerville, Ohio drunken arrest incident. By doing so, perhaps his shaky mental condition at the time, the guilt he felt over being complicit in Kilgallen's death, caused the words he wrote to have surfaced from his subconscious, a confession of sorts. Commenting on the potential that Kilgallen was too close to the truth concerning solving the JFK and Oswald assassinations and had to be stopped, Pataki paused before speaking. He then said, "Of course it's plausible. She had enemies. She had enemies. Is it plausible one of them wanted her dead?" Pataki then added, "One or more. She was a brash writer. She made a lot of enemies. Not everyone adored Dorothy." Asked about danger to Kilgallen's life, Pataki stated, "She told me. She said, I get threats. I said, anything we can talk about? She said no." Most curious is why Pataki, while discounting the importance of the vodka roulette scene as relief possibility poem, could recite the few stanzas verbatim, one that featured vodka, Kilgallen's drink of choice, as if he had written the poem quite recently. He did this without any hesitation, blurting the words out the moment this author mentioned the name of the poem. Had he indeed experienced relief once Kilgallen was dead? By eliminating her, he had satisfied those who could have hired him to do the dirty work, and in addition, she was certainly unable to soil his reputation by circulating to the entertainment world and to friends that he could not be trusted. That in fact, Pataki was a snitch. The latter would have destroyed any career aspirations he might have had. A true benefit from the crime if Pataki was involved, since Kilgallen ended up being somebody who's dead, who could tell no tales. If Ron Pataki was indeed the mystery man who met Kilgallen on the weekend of her death, what is the rest of the story? The real truth about Kilgallen's tragic demise? No doubt exists that Ron Pataki had redeeming qualities. In the 1960s, he had settled into a position as a competent arts and theater columnist whose works were well-written and dynamic in tone. Apparently, he was blessed with good friendships and impressive enough to have romantic relationships with famous women closer to his own age, including Mia Farrow and then Alberghetti, to whom he was engaged to be married. Then Kilgallen came along and thought enough of him to share her JFK assassination investigation evidence that she apparently shared with no one else. This pretends, at least in this instance, to a level of trust, and Kilgallen did not trust too many people. Women of fame besides Alberghetti and Farrow were enamored with Pataki, somehow apparently seeing the good in him. One of note is actress Sandy Dennis, star of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Up the Down Staircase. She won an Oscar for a stunning performance in the former film, and in a newly discovered photograph of Pataki and her, Dennis's smile seems to indicate a fondness for him. No doubt exists, however, that Pataki had a nasty side to him. He was a heavy drinker, and had the propensity for exaggerating the truth or downright lying. A side that dwelled within an ambitious man who discarded women, was always short of money, and jealous of society types in the big city, who never permitted him to be one of them. Pataki also appeared to have an obsession with the dark side of life. In a July 1, 1966 column, printed 8 months after Kilgallen died, perhaps because of his affection for Dennis, he lauded the film Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which had been highly criticized for its dark theme and tone. He wrote, "The film is the best picture of the year. That its brutal dialogue will offend some people is certain. But none of director Edward Albee's dialogue is wasted. He has created a harshly real, very ugly picture of four unfortunate human beings. You will see and hear the worst of human emotions explored." This side of Pataki, the star-struck, overly ambitious columnist, described by Anna Maria Alberghetti as violent and nutsy, as a man who, when he drank, went bananas, was the one vulnerable to any powerful forces who knew of his weaknesses. The one who said is noted that he knew Kilgallen better and more intimately than anyone. Did they, the ones who feared Kilgallen, Hoover, Marcello, contact as a request, or lean on Pataki to monitor the famous journalist and then report the evidence she had discovered? Perhaps he reluctantly agreed, or was pressured to agree either by use of threats and even force, or through being paid. When it became apparent Kilgallen was too close to the truth, was Pataki told that Kilgallen must be stopped? Did he then further agree to betray Kilgallen and become complicit in her death? retired Dutchess County, New York Sheriff's Office Detective Dennis O'Keefe, who, as noted, reviewed the circumstances surrounding Kilgallen's death, certainly suspected Pataki of wrongdoing. He told this author, "It appears to me that Ron Pataki has dirty hands regarding Kilgallen's death." To provide Ron Pataki with an opportunity to clear up inconsistent statements through the years, the former newspaper columnist was interviewed by this author during the early days of September 2015. During the course of the back-and-forth discussion, Pataki continued to deny any romantic relationship with Kilgallen during their two-year relationship. "I don't believe I ever kissed her on the mouth, just on the cheek. And there was love, there was a deep love, a friendship love, but we were just never sexually involved at all." That he sent Kilgallen Valentine cutouts. "I don't believe I've ever sent a Valentine in my life. I'm not a Valentine kind of guy." This contradicts Mark Sinclair's account. Leaking any information about Kilgallen's JFK and Oswald assassination investigation to anyone. "She told me someone had leaked information, but she didn't know who it was. Never, never gave me any names." That the poems he wrote were in any way a subconscious effort to cleanse a guilty conscience regarding his involvement in her death. "The bottom line is, I am utterly, my conscience is clear. I have no part in anything involving Dorothy's death." The need to respond to those people, accusing him of wrongdoing. "I don't want to lower myself to deal with despicable people." Regarding new information Pataki provided, the following are of interest. "Kilgallen told me she was afraid of those who feared her JFK and Oswald investigation and her writing a book, but she never gave me any names, never told me whom." He did not attend Kilgallen's funeral because, "I didn't like the people in New York City, and most of them didn't like me. They felt I had taken over a lot of Dorothy's life and social life." Concerning Jack Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission, he stated, "You know what? For about 6 months, I had the second copy of his testimony before it was released publicly. She sent it to me." Asked why Kilgallen sent it to him, he said, "I don't know. She probably sent along a note and asked, 'What do you think of this?' There was nothing sinister about it. It's hard for me in any way to be sinister about Dorothy." Pataki suggesting that there was a second copy of Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission that Kilgallen shared with him appears far-fetched. However, if it did happen, once again, this evidence points to Pataki being the perfect Judas to double-cross the famed reporter and leak her assassination investigation results to the wrong people. Adding to the potential that this happened are several accounts to be taken into consideration regarding Pataki's financial well-being during the final days of 1965. First up is Mark Sinclair stating in his videotaped interview that Kilgallen told him Pataki didn't have any money at all. She said, "Small newspaper, small job." According to Brenda DeJordan, Kilgallen helped Pataki financially. One instance she recalled dealt with the gift of a Thunderbird, stating during her interview with this author, "That summer, 1965, there was something about a Thunderbird outside. There was this car sitting there, and I asked my father, 'Do Dorothy and Dick have a new car?' He said, 'No, that's somebody else's car.' And then it disappeared. I think it was red, a convertible, since that was the only model." In late 2017 and early 2018, new, important evidence emerged regarding Pataki's life and times and his conduct directly relating to his relationship with Kilgallen and what he knew about her death, since the sources were his own relatives. The first instance happened when Southern California resident Ken Edwards learned of Kilgallen's case when this author appeared twice on the Coast to Coast radio program with George Noory. Edwards knew John Downing, Ron Pataki's first cousin, and Edwards told this author he recalled Downing telling him the following. Pataki told John his relationship with Dorothy was definitely sexual. Pataki said Dorothy had given him an apartment house and a Thunderbird automobile. This confirms Brenda DeJordan's account regarding the car. Pataki told him he was the last person to see Dorothy alive. Deciding to discover whether there might be other family members who knew Pataki, Edwards checked Pataki's Facebook page and noticed that one of his friends was Joyce Darling. Edwards told this author, "Joyce and my friend John Downing were first cousins, and although I'd never met her, I'd heard a great deal about her from John. So I decided to contact Joyce. We spoke mainly about John, who died back in 2011, but eventually turned the conversation toward Ron Pataki, who's also her first cousin." Edwards, who knew Pataki's mother's maiden name was Darling, then added, "Here's the fascinating part. When I mentioned that John had told me about the apartment house and the Thunderbird, she immediately confirmed that as truth. She referred to Ron as Kilgallen's boy toy, said the relationship between them was sexual, and that Ron was a gigolo. Joyce said he went to L.A. and dated many women until things got hot." Edwards had more information to convey about Pataki based on his conversation with Darling. "And then out of the blue and unprompted by me," Joyce stated, "Ron was the last person to see her alive. She said that with absolute certainty. I asked if she meant that he was with her when she died, to which she responded, he was the last person to see her alive." Very cryptic. "And I didn't press her any further, as the main reason for contacting her was to speak about her beloved cousin, my friend John." Continuing his quest to find out more about Pataki, Edwards contacted Pataki's first cousin, Belva Elliott, John Downing's sister. Edwards told this author, "Belva said there was no reason to dig up the past, don't want to hurt Ronnie. But she said Ron admitted the poems he wrote about the poisoning, about one who cannot write who is zippered tight, were about Dorothy." Edwards also said Elliot told him, "Ron said Kilgallen was poisoned because she was too close to the truth about the JFK assassination. He would not say by whom. I can confirm Kilgallen bought an apartment for Ron and a Thunderbird. Ron said he talked to Dorothy just before she died, and she felt her life was in danger. I still talk to Ron from time to time. He lives with a Japanese woman who takes care of him, and he's so handsome. I love him to pieces." Pataki does live with an Asian woman. The family was known as the Drunken Downings of Vermilion County. Ron drank with John Downing, and when people drink, they tell the truth. In a later conversation, on April 27, 2018, Edwards told this author Belva Elliott recalled the car since Eleanor, another first cousin of Ron, who had married money, loved Thunderbirds, and Eleanor and Ron had driven them to an Illinois town where Belva saw the cars. Edwards said Belva admitted speaking to Pataki 6 weeks ago, while stating that he told her, "I was the last person to see Dorothy alive. I was at her apartment the night she died, the last one to leave the building." Neither Joyce Darling nor Belva Elliott agreed to speak with this author, each explaining to Edwards that it was all about protecting family matters, while being aware Edwards would pass along what they told him to this author. Without question, what the two women told Edwards are second-hand accounts, hearsay. But when a case like Kilgallen's is 50-plus years old, any evidence must be presented when it concerns a homicide, so the accuracy may be evaluated. Since the accounts provided by John Downing, Darling, and Elliot appear to square up, the information is certainly valuable. Whether Pataki conveyed these facts to the women while under the influence of too much alcohol, based on a lifelong problem filled with drunken episodes, whether he was simply playing the big shot, bragging about what had happened with Kilgallen, or whether he possessed a subconscious desire out of guilt to admit complicity in her death, is unknown. What the two first cousins reported adds to the plethora of evidence about whether Pataki was somehow involved with Kilgallen's death. One true fact. If Darling and Elliot are correct, the Pataki told her he was the last person to see Kilgallen alive, and in Elliot's case, that he was at Kilgallen's apartment the night she died, and the last one to leave the building. This appears to be solid incriminating evidence, solidifying the belief that Pataki was the mystery man with her at the Regency Hotel bar before she died. The fact that Kilgallen lavished gifts on Pataki, since his salary was minimal, highlights his financial concerns and targets him as the kiss-and-tell representative of whatever faction it is that did not want the facts about the JFK assassination to emerge. An operative, a snitch, who, by his actions one way or another, caused the death of Kilgallen. That Kilgallen was the type of woman Pataki was drawn to is solidified through primary source insight into his mindset toward women, especially those like Kilgallen, who were either wealthy or in positions of power, from two sisters who knew Pataki in the mid-1990s in Hollywood. Though this was over 30 years after Kilgallen died, their observations are important, since this author's attempts to locate people who knew Pataki well had been difficult. During a late March 2018 interview with this author, gifted singer Camille Renoir, a close friend of Johnny Mathis to the extent of writing an official blog about his life and times, johnnymathisappreciationsociety.blogspot.com, explained that she knew Pataki through her mother, an influential public relations executive who represented big-name celebrities. Ron took her to red carpet events, Renoir recalled. She loved to wear her evening gowns. Renoir's impressions of Pataki, approaching 60 years old while Renoir was 17 or 18, were quite revealing. She said, "He was quite charming, really, good-looking, but starstruck with women, wanted to be around celebrities. He even asked me out and my older sister Marianne, too. He had some good pickup lines. Reminded me of actor Robert Wagner when he was young. The kind of guy who liked the glamour of Hollywood. Wanted to be part of the beautiful people. But Ron never made it." Asked whether Pataki was a womanizer, Renoir, who recalled Pataki staying at her home, stated, "Not exactly, but I could see it. He was like somebody who had a plan and then carries it out. Like a schemer. Saw women as an opportunity. Used people. Used my mom to get to her famous friends. Not genuine. Didn't respect women. One who could turn on the charm when he wanted something. I felt like Ron would have liked to have found a rich wife and just made the rounds of the parties." Renoir, who recalled that Pataki was introduced to her mother through mutual friends in Columbus, Ohio, said Pataki's two poems could be construed toward guilt, of his pulling troubling events out of his subconscious, of having a hand in Dorothy's death. She added, "And despite his desire to see and be seen with the so-called beautiful people, there always seemed to be a sadness about him, kind of an aura of sadness, that he wasn't a happy person. He seemed to be present, yet far away at times. One time, out of the blue, he asked me to go with him to the airport, LAX, and watch the planes take off and land. But when we were there, he seemed kind of somewhere else with his thoughts, seemed sad." Summing up, Renoir said, "Maybe he was upset about his mother's death. Daisy Pataki Wallet, nicknamed Day, died in 1996 unexpectedly, at age 82 during surgery. Or Dorothy, I don't know." Concerning Pataki's relationships with women, Renoir, whose godmother was acclaimed singer Ella Fitzgerald, explained, "Since Dorothy wasn't beautiful in the classic manner, like Ava Gardner or Grace Kelly, I don't see her as his type, for instance, like Anna Maria Alberghetti." Asked then why Pataki would have been interested in Kilgallen, Renoir said, "Connections, decoration, just like with my mother's situation, to use her." Renoir's sister Marianne, 20 years Camille's senior, weighed in on Pataki through a May 14th email forwarded to this author by Renoir. Marianne, who was not aware of Pataki's violent tendencies and various brushes with the law, stated, "Our relationship was a very private one, based on mutual love and trust. I will tell you this much. Ron could no more harm a person, any person, than he could sprout wings and fly to the moon. I know this, Kiki," Camille's nickname. "I know it. You know, if I say I do, I do. I would stake my life on it. I would stake Mary's, Marianne's daughter's, life. Ron is such a dear, dear heart in my life." Renoir had her own opinion, one certainly differing from her sister's. She told this author, "You know, maybe Ron didn't know they were going to murder Kilgallen, just scare her," without pinpointing who they were. Renoir also said, "Ron looked out for Ron, first and foremost. Asked if she believed Pataki could kill someone, she stated, not actually kill someone, unless that is his life was in danger. He'd be afraid to kill. But if pressured, perhaps by mafia guys, I can see him doing it."